Paul Tavilla for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again Monday for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we continue our series of Oscar-winning films. This year, the Academy Awards ceremony is Sunday, April 25th. Each Saturday until April 24th, we'll select an audio-described movie from each decade that won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Saturday, we're showing All About Eve from 1950, starring Betty Davis, Ann Baxter, and George Sanders.
I'm not 20, I'm not 30. 3 months ago, I was 40 years old. 40.
Got to see her. She worships her.
Let me tell you about Eve. She's got everything. A born actress. Young, exciting, vibrant.
Don't run out of adjectives, do you?
How can such a woman fool so many?
How does any Eve do it?
The audio-described Best Picture of 1950, All About Eve, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Don't forget to set your clock ahead 1 hour before you go to bed Saturday night.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 77 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-60s. Then tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello, this is Michael with a programming reminder. The coronavirus update will now air this afternoon following the local newspapers at 4:30 p.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Hello and welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I didn't mention it last weekend when I was wrapping up the recording, but this weekend is Golden Globes weekend. Tomorrow night's the big show, so I have some reading from Entertainment Weekly online to cover all the nominees and who they're predicting will win. First, I've got your editor's letter. This is a weekly dispatch that comes to me in email. I'd officially like to welcome you all to award season, where Hollywood gets all dolled up, makes fun of itself, and only a few of the most deserving contenders actually end up with awards. This year is going to be particularly interesting considering, well, the past year. I'd actually argue that 2020 put forth a number of award-worthy films and shows, but in typical Golden Globes fashion, we're about to kick things off on a weird note. Not only did the Globes ignore the greatness of I May Destroy You, and many others, and recognize the mediocrity of The Prom, but there was one particular nomination that I will never forgive, Emily in Paris. That ridiculous show everyone watched and collectively agreed was fun but terrible. And they nominated it! Not only that, but they nominated it in the spot where my beloved Never Have I Ever should have gone. This is all to say, welcome to another award season where nothing is as it should be. What show or movie do you want to see walk away with a Golden Globe? Until next week, Sam, and her Twitter address is @SamHighphil. 5 things to say at a virtual party. The best and worst news of the week. Number 1, R.I.P. Daft Punk, says those two people you know who loved Daft Punk. Number 2, Criminal Minds being revived for Paramount Plus means Hollywood is officially out of ideas, yes? Number 3, Landry makes first string. Jesse Plemons is set to star in Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. Number 4, Mom is ending. News that will surely upset some people you know, though not the same ones that are upset about Daft Punk. Number 5, Shonda Rhimes is creating a live-action Wednesday Addams series. Just kidding. That's obviously a Tim Burton project, but isn't it fun to imagine what Rhimes would do? Under the What to Watch category, all your TV dilemmas sorted. Billie Eilish, The World's a Little Blurry. That was out February 26th on Apple TV+. go on the road and behind the scenes with the young Grammy-winning singer-songwriter for an in-depth look inside her world. The Golden Globes are on February 28th on NBC. We've been over this. The Walking Dead, also on February 28th on AMC. The hit zombie series is finally back for more walking and, I'm sure, more death. I've never seen it. The Voice, March 1st on NBC. Nick Jonas once again joins Kelly Clarkson, John Legend, and Blake Shelton for some chair-turning, bickering, and eventually singing. And to binge, you want to watch Shameless on Netflix. After 11 seasons, the Gallaghers are saying goodbye, so why not go back and revisit their entire journey? In the last section, special guest staffer, this is what editorial assistant Sly Sanchez loves right now. And his Twitter address is @OhMySanchez, OhMySanchez. His pick, Fake Famous on HBO. In HBO's recent documentary from journalist Nick Bilton, three unknowns are given the opportunity of a lifetime to be the next big Instagram stars. But before any of the glamour comes their way, each is pushed to buy followers and comments, inflating their engagement before they go fake the glitz. Putting their self-esteem on the line, all three then participate in a number of shortcuts, photo shoots in a kiddie pool, anyone? To feed the beast of popularity. It's an alarming social experiment on the now widely available price of fame for just capital B being. Truly an emotional wrecking ball. No, not the one with Miley Cyrus on top of it. That was our editor's letter, the weekly dispatch that we get in email. Now I'm going over to Entertainment Weekly to learn about everything to know about the 2021 Golden Globes. From where and when to watch to who's hosting and more. This is by Lauren Huff. Another year, another award season. Unlike prior years, however, Hollywood still has the coronavirus pandemic to contend with, which lends some uncertainty to the proceedings. First out of the gate will be the 2021 Golden Globe Awards, which normally take place in early January, but this year have been pushed back to February 28th. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler are reprising their role as hosts of the annual awards celebration. They previously hosted in 2013, 2014, and 2015, which, as always, celebrates the best of the year in television and film. The effects of the COVID-19 pandemic will not go unacknowledged during the telecast, with Feeding America signing on as a philanthropic partner of the event. Throughout the evening, viewers will be informed of the Hunger Relief Organization's response efforts in retaliation to the health crisis. In preparation for Hollywood's big night, Entertainment Weekly has rounded up everything you need to know, including how and where to watch and more. When are the Golden Globe Awards this year? The 78th annual Golden Globe Awards will air live coast to coast on NBC on Sunday, February 28th, 2021 at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific Time from the Beverly Hilton Hotel. It is unclear at this time how exactly the show will look with regards to in-person attendees and live versus pre-taped elements. How can I watch the show? Anyone with cable access can watch the show live on NBC or via the NBC website or app. Those who don't have cable or satellite subscription have other options, however. The show will be available on the Roku channel, and although exact details for this year are yet to be confirmed, usually paid subscription services such as Fubo TV, Sling TV, Hulu with Live TV, YouTube TV, and AT&T TV now also carry the show. And if you don't subscribe to any of those, many services offer a free trial you can utilize for the occasion. Will there be a pre-show or red carpet coverage? NBC and E! Entertainment are joining forces to offer fans a double dose of celebrity-filled entertainment in a handful of pre- and post-shows. Kicking off the day's coverage at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, that's 4 p.m. Eastern Time, actress Sarah Hyland joins E!'s Nina Parker, Erin Lim, and stylist Brad Goreski on Live from E! Countdown to the Golden Globes, as they count down the top 20 biggest red carpet show-stopping moments. There will also be the Golden Globes pre-show on NBC, which will be hosted by Jane Lynch and Susan Kelechi Watson, who will present live interviews with a slew of nominees and other stars. In addition, the hour-long telecast will feature the most memorable, funniest, and indelible moments in Golden Globes history. Over on E!, Juliana Rancic and the special guest co-host, Caranimo, headline live from E! Golden Globes, bringing viewers interviews live from the Beverly Hilton with Hollywood's biggest stars and nominees. Joining Rancic and Caranimo will be E!'s style correspondent, Zanna Roberts-Rassi and Aaron Lim, host of E! News, The Rundown. NBC's Golden Globes pre-show is set to begin at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, while live from E!, Golden Globes will begin an hour earlier at 3 Pacific Time or 6 Eastern Time. Who is hosting? As mentioned above, Faye and Poehler will be taking over the hosting duties for the fourth time. The duo will be tackling their roles on separate coasts for the first time in Globes history, with Faye in New York and Poehler in Los Angeles. In addition, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the organization behind the awards, has announced that this year's Globes ambassadors assisting with the handing out of the trophies will be Satchel and Jackson Lee, children of three-time Golden Globe nominee Spike Lee and producer Tanya Lewis Lee. This marks the first time in HFPA history that two siblings of color have held the position, with Jackson being the first black male ambassador. Will the show feature live presenters? Entertainment Weekly can confirm that presenters will be joining Faye and Poehler in person at the Rainbow Room inside Rockefeller Center in New York City or at the Beverly Hilton in LA. On February 17th, the HFPA announced the first batch of presenters, including Awkwafina, Cynthia Erivo, Annie Mumolo, Joaquin Phoenix, Kristen Wiig, and Renee Zellweger. Kevin Bacon, Sterling K. Brown, Michael Douglas, Kira Sedgwick, Susan Kelechi Watson, and Catherine Zeta-Jones were added to the list on February 19th. Anthony Anderson, Tiffany Haddish, Kate Hudson, Margot Robbie, Kenan Thompson, and Bryce Dallas Howard, Christopher Maloney, Rosie Perez, Christian Slater, Angela Bassett, Laura Dern, Salma Hayek, and Jamie Lee Curtis have also been confirmed. Who's nominated? Nominations for the 78th Golden Globes were announced on February 3rd. Netflix's Mank and The Crown were the big winners of film and television, each with six nods. Netflix was the big winner overall, with a whopping 42 nominations across all categories. Who else is being honored? This year's recipient of the Cecil B. DeMille Award, the award show's version of a Lifetime Achievement honor, is seven-time Globe winner and two-time Oscar winner Jane Fonda. Fonda joins the illustrious ranks of past Cecil B. DeMille Award honorees that includes Tom Hanks, Oprah Winfrey, and Jeff Bridges. That was everything to know about the 2021 Golden Globes. And now, I have the full list of nominees. Golden Globes 2021 winner predictions. Entertainment Weekly picks who should and who will win. This is by Kristen Baldwin. It's Hollywood's biggest party, kind of. We still don't know exactly what this year's Golden Globes will look like, with Amy Poehler and Tina Fey returning to co-host, only this time from opposite coasts, for a socially distanced edition. But we feel a bit more confident making our guesses about the winners. As always, expect some telling Oscar previews, a few wild upsets, and a bit of Ryan Murphy love. Check out Entertainment Weekly's predictions in the major movie and TV categories here, as well as our feelings on who should win. This being the quirky Globes, there isn't always a ton of overlap. The Golden Globes air this Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time on NBC. The first category is Best Motion Picture Drama. The nominees are The Father, Mank, Nomadland, Promising Young Woman, and The Trial of the Chicago 7. Who should and will win? Nomadland. the HFPA loves to anoint an Oscar frontrunner, and they're clearly high on Nomadland, even handing it a screenplay nod. Watch out for another favorite among these voters, though, Aaron Sorkin's talkie, prescient, Chicago 7. That was by David Canfield. Best Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy, Borat, Subsequent Movie Film, Hamilton, Music, Palm Springs, and The Prom. Who should win? They say Borat, Subsequent Movie Film, and who will win? Hamilton. This category's age-old tension, spectacle or laughs. If the latter, Sacha Baron Cohen's Wild Borat sequel should fit the bill, and our critic, Leah Greenblatt, picking our movie shoulds, hopes as much. But Disney Plus's Hamilton film may be just too rousing to deny. That was by David Canfield. Best Director for a Motion Picture is next. Here are our directors: Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman, David Fincher for Mank, Regina King for One Night in Miami, Aaron Sorkin for The Trial of the Chicago 7, and Chloe Zhao for Nomadland. Who should and will win? Chloe Zhao. Emerald Fennell's breakout drama has proved to be a promising contender with surprise nods across the board, but support for Chloe Zhao will continue her steamroll through the precursors, enough for a win here. That was by Joey Nolfi. Best Actor in a Motion Picture Drama: Riz Ahmed in Sound of Metal, Chadwick Boseman for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Anthony Hopkins for The Father, Gary Oldman for Mank, and Tahar Rahim for The Mauritian. Who should and will win? Chadwick Boseman. The late Boseman is rightly the frontrunner for his career-best turn in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. However, the HFPA wasn't crazy about the movie overall. Anthony Hopkins is a worthy challenger. That was by David Canfield. Best Actress in a Motion Picture Drama: Viola Davis for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Andra Day, The United States versus Billie Holiday, Vanessa Kirby, Pieces of a Woman, Frances McDormand for Nomadland, and Carey Mulligan for Promising Young Woman. Who should and will win? Carey Mulligan. Promising Young Woman dressed Mulligan to kill, and she's poised to slay award season with a mammoth swell of support fueling her bid. Her brilliant, beloved performance captures the fiery feminist sentiment of a cultural moment. Expect the HFPA to endorse the movement and the excellence. That was by Joey Nolfi. Best Actor in a Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy: Sacha Baron Cohen from Borat's Subsequent Movie Film, James Corden from The Prom, Lin-Manuel Miranda for Hamilton, Dev Patel for The Personal History of David Copperfield, and Andy Samberg for Palm Springs. Who should and will win? Sacha Baron Cohen. In 2007, Baron Cohen won the award for the original Borat. In a scattered field of lower profile and, in James Corden's case, poorly received work, he stands an excellent shot of taking the trophy again 14 years later. But don't rule out a Hamilton wave. For Best Actress in a Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy, we have Maria Bakalova from Borat's Subsequent Movie Film, Kate Hudson in Music, Michelle Pfeiffer in French Exit, Rosamund Pike in I Care a Lot, and Anya Taylor-Joy in Emma. Who should win? Anya Taylor-Joy. Who will win? Maria Bakalova. Bakalova gives one of the best performances of the year in a widely seen digital blockbuster. Plus, HFPA loves anointing future superstars, and Bakalova is poised to blow up. That was by Joey Nolfi. Best Supporting Actor in a Motion Picture: Sacha Baron Cohen, The Trial of the Chicago 7, Daniel Kaluuya in Judas and the Black Messiah, Jared Leto in The Little Things, Bill Murray in On the Rocks, and Leslie Odom Jr. in One Night in Miami. Who should and will win? Daniel Kaluuya. Baron Cohen's got the biggest movie behind him, but he'll likely win for Borat. Any voter who watches Judas and the Black Messiah will have a hard time not selecting the electric Daniel Kaluuya. That was by David Canfield. Best Supporting Actress in a Motion Picture, Glenn Close in Hillbilly Elegy, Olivia Colman in The Father, Jodie Foster in The Mauritian, Amanda Seyfried in Mank, and Helena Zengel in News of the World. Who should win? Helena Zengel. Who will win? Olivia Colman. Fear the wrath of a mama scorned, but we see another Colman over Close duel ending as it did at the Oscars in 2019. The HFPA adores the multi-globe winning crown star. Helena Zengel holds her own with Tom Hanks, we should note, and deserves a look too. That was by Joey Nolfi. Best Screenplay for a Motion Picture. The Father, written by Christopher Hampton and Florian Zeller. Mank, written by Jack Fincher. Nomadland, written by Chloe Zhao. Promising Young Woman, written by Emerald Fennell. And The Trial of the Chicago Seven, written by Aaron Sorkin. Who will and should win? Promising Young Woman. The Golden Globes can safely recognize Fennell's thematically rich work here by lifting up the words that sparked Mulligan's fire. These are all Best Picture players, of course. Another favorite may be quietly lurking. That was by Joey Nolfi. Those were all the movie categories. Now we'll take a look at TV. Best Television Series, Drama. Our options are The Crown, Lovecraft Country, The Mandalorian, Ozark, and Ratched. Who should win? The Crown. Who will win? Ratched. Trust this voting body to throw some curveballs. So, in a category with buzzy Ozark, uber popular The Mandalorian, timely Lovecraft Country, and maybe the finest year of The Crown yet, we're anticipating a Ratched upset. Is Ratched even, like, good? No. But it is, by default, Ryan Murphy's best Netflix drama, and the producer is a Globes favorite. That was by Darren French. Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Series, Drama. We have Olivia Colman in The Crown, Jodie Comer in Killing Eve, Emma Corrin in The Crown, Laura Linney in Ozark, and Sarah Paulson in Ratched. Who should win? Olivia Colman. Who will win? Emma Corrin. Colman has won 3 Globes in 5 years, so despite her powerful final crown year, another royal will seize the throne. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association loves a glamorous newcomer, and Emma Corrin's star turn as Diana is literally about glamorously newcoming. That was by Darren French. Best Performance by an Actor in a Television Series, Drama. Jason Bateman in Ozark, Bob Odenkirk for Better Call Saul, Josh O'Connor in The Crown, Al Pacino in Hunters, and Matthew Rhys in Perry Mason. Who should win? Bob Odenkirk. Who will win? Al Pacino. Jason Bateman and Bob Odenkirk have already lost in this category twice and 3 times, respectively. Perry Mason wasn't flashy enough for the Globes. Josh O'Connor gave a bittersweet and moving performance as Prince Charles, but Al Pacino as a gruff and growly Nazi killer? The HFPA won't be able to resist. That was by Kristen Baldwin. Best Television Series, Musical or Comedy, Emily in Paris, The Flight Attendant, The Great, Schitt's Creek, and Ted Lasso. Who should and will win? Ted Lasso. The Globes love to put their stamp on a buzzy new comedy, which probably rules out Schitt's Creek, which swept the 2020 Emmys. And given that Apple TV Plus has only one real shot at a major award from the HFPA this year, expect them to go all out with their campaign for Coach Lasso. That was by Kristen Baldwin. Best Performance by an Actress in a Television Series, Musical or Comedy. Catherine O'Hara in Schitt's Creek. Kaley Cuoco for The Flight Attendant. Elle Fanning in The Great. Jane Levy for Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. And Lily Collins for Emily in Paris. Who should and will win? Kaley Cuoco. Rather than replicating the Emmy's outpouring of love for Schitt's Creek, the Globes will look to anoint a new queen of comedy. only Lily Collins has been nominated before in 2017 for Rules Don't Apply, but God willing, voters will just say nom to Emily. Kaylee Cuoco is masterfully madcap on the flight attendant, and she has the star power to push her over the edge. That was by Kristen Baldwin. Best performance by an actor in a television series, musical, or comedy. We have Don Cheadle in Black Monday, Nicholas Holt for The Great, Eugene Levy in Schitt's Creek, Jason Sudeikis in Ted Lasso, and Rami Youssef in Rami. Should and will win, Jason Sudeikis. Can you believe this is Eugene Levy's first ever Golden Globes nomination? The same can be said for his Creek star O'Hara. Still, this is Sudeikis' category to lose. His heartwarming, hilarious performance as an American optimist in London saved many a viewer's sanity in 2020. That was by Kristen Baldwin. For best performance by an actress in a supporting role in a series, limited series, or motion picture made for television, we have Gillian Anderson in The Crown, Helena Bonham Carter in The Crown, Cynthia Nixon in Ratchet, Annie Murphy in Schitt's Creek, and Julia Garner in Ozark. Who should and will win? Gillian Anderson. Much like the Iron Lady herself, Anderson cannot and will not be denied. Her performance as Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher is about as visceral and authentic as it gets. Here's hoping the actress thanks her bouffant wig in her acceptance speech. That was by Kristen Baldwin. Best performance by an actor in a supporting role in a series, limited series, or motion picture made for television. We have John Boyega from Small Act, Donald Sutherland in The Undoing, Dan Levy in Schitt's Creek, Brendan Gleeson from The Comey Rule, and Jim Parsons in Hollywood. Should and will win, John Boyega. It's almost not fair, since the actor is the full-fledged lead of Red, White, and Blue, his chapter of the Small Acts anthology. But his stunning turn as a boundary-breaking black police officer, Leroy Logan, is a marvel of controlled passions. Leroy is condemned by his racist colleagues and ostracized from a community that considers him a race traitor. It's a soulful performance that blends hope and fury. That was by Darren French. Best television series or motion picture made for television. We have Normal People, Small Acts, The Queen's Gambit, The Undoing, and Unorthodox. What show should win? Small Acts. What will win? The Queen's Gambit. Call it what you will. Streaming cinema, anthology, movie collection, Steve McQueen's Small Acts is an astonishment of sociopolitical riches. But in a category packed with word-of-mouth sensations, the addictive Queen's Gambit should simultaneously checkmate all four opponents. That was by Darren French. Best performance by an actor in a limited series or motion picture made for television, Bryan Cranston in Your Honor, Jeff Daniels in The Comey Rule, Hugh Grant in The Undoing, Ethan Hawke in The Good Lord Bird, and Mark Ruffalo in I Know This Much Is True. Who should win? Ethan Hawke. Who will win? Hugh Grant. Pour one out for Morgan Spector, snubbed for his furiously vital work in The Plot Against America. Heck, pour one out for the eventually unnominated Plot Against America. Hawke could win just for most acting, but Hugh Grant's years-long comeback will win over Undoing finale skeptics. That was by Darren French. Here's our last one. Best performance for an actress in a limited series or motion picture made for television, Cate Blanchett in Mrs. America, Daisy Edgar-Jones in Normal People, Shira Haas in Unorthodox, Nicole Kidman in The Undoing, and Anya Taylor-Joy in The Queen's Gambit. Who should and will win? Anya Taylor-Joy, acclaimed ingenues, and your favorite awardee Australians make this a uniquely stacked lineup. Count on Anya Taylor-Joy, though. The Queen's Gambit is mostly deep thoughts about chess pieces, but her brilliantly destructive prodigy transformed the internal drama into the year's most addictive binge. That was by Darren French. And there you have it, the Golden Globes 2021 winner predictions Entertainment Weekly picks who should and who will win. That was by Kristen Baldwin, David Canfield, Darren French, and Joey Nolte. And I'm actually a little late in my halfway through reminder that you are listening to Entertainment Weekly. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. Next I'm going to hop over to the magazine, but I'm not going to start at the very beginning of the March issue. I'm going to go into the middle section and start with the news and reviews section because I won't be able to get through the entire first article in the time that we have. This first article is in the movies section, The Awardist, Becoming Billy. Grammy nominee Andra Day, 36, makes a stunning acting debut as a musical legend in The United States vs. Billie Holiday on Hulu February 26. This is by David Canfield. How do you recreate the voice of one of the greatest singers ever? For her transformation into jazz legend Billie Holiday, Andra Day threw out the rule book. She started smoking cigarettes. She glugged cold water and gin. She yelled and screamed all the time, leaving her vocal cords no time to rest. The gravel and the grit in Holiday's voice is so much a part of her character, she explains. Anything I do to take care of my voice as a singer, I did the opposite. It's one thing to commit to such a regimen as a seasoned actor. It's another entirely if you're a Grammy-nominated artist stepping into her first acting role. The experience changed her. There's still some residual Billy, Day says, with a throaty laugh. Parts of her will always be with me. Starring debuts rarely come this big, and Day didn't entertain the opportunity at first. Hell no, was her initial reaction. Director Lee Daniels, from Empire, didn't see her in the movie either. Their managers thought they'd click, though, and persuaded them to get together. We sat in the meeting like, why are we here, Day recalls. I don't think they're going to be good. I don't think I'm going to be good. But they connected, particularly over Daniel's vision to move beyond previous depictions of Holiday and focus on the federal government's effort to censor and frame her, hence the title, The United States vs. Billie Holiday. An avowed Holiday fan, compelled by the bold approach, they auditioned a little more than 3 years ago and quickly got the part. Adapted from Johann Harry's 2015 drug criminalization book, Chasing the Scream, the film is no ordinary biopic. Daniels and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Susan Laurie Parks from Effing A have crafted a pointed, nuanced portrait of a magnetic presence whose light couldn't be dimmed, to fans, to friends, to history, even as addiction struggles mounted and powerful forces worked relentlessly to silence her. It's a significant cultural reframing that would weigh heavily on any actor. For Day, best known for her multi-platinum-selling 2015 single, Rise Up, no element of character building was minor. She researched every book, every interview, every song, picking up on the tiniest of details from Holiday's talent for topic swerving. She'll go from talking about a crazy story about discrimination to being like, you know, Lester just loved my mother's cooking, to her laugh, a pinging like it'd come back and hit against something. Getting it all right required years of intensive preparation, also a lot of self-maiming, though Day's turn as the blues singer doesn't quite show that. There's an effortless kind of melody to the performance. It's deceptively precise, more interested in the human than the icon. Still, the screen novice had to navigate an unfamiliar process. She vividly recalls the first time, after 18 or so months of buildup, she actually performed as Lady Day for the camera. The scene, a sold-out Carnegie Hall concert. The number, Ain't Nobody's Business If I Do. She sang her heart out. The crowd and crew roared. She'd done it. And then she had to do it again. We did it like 800 million times, Day deadpans. As a singer, we're used to, you get on stage, you perform, and everybody's like, yay! It was all a lesson for me. Not just technically. The film's most pivotal scenes cast Day with the song Strange Fruit, whose lyrics unflinchingly describe a lynching. It's a window into the movie's central conflict, the government tried to stop Holiday from singing it, as well as its subject's soul. Performing it was traumatic and healing at the same time, Day says. I'm a black woman living in America, and that has its own set of traumas. And a lynching is a horrific, horrific sight. It is very much in the fabric of American culture. Day gained clarity from facing that reality head on, but this all being so new, she struggled to shake it off. She watched her co-stars, including Trevante Rhodes as her charming suitor and Natasha Lyonne as her secret lover, in awe. They have that muscle that allows them to come out and then drop back in as if they were never out of it, she explains. For me, coming off set felt impossible. So much so that she sometimes can't imagine doing anything like it again. But regardless of what she does on screen next, Day calls the movie one of the greatest experiences of her life, and Billie Holiday one of its greatest gifts. I really love her, Day says. I loved having her in me, and I loved being in her. That was Becoming Billie by David Canfield, and then we have a sidebar here, Holiday Party, the most memorable Lady Day turns. There's Diana Ross in Lady Sings the Blues in 1972. Ross took on Holiday in her first film role and scored an Oscar nomination. Dee Dee Bridgewater in Lady Day, 1986. She starred in the musical for 20-plus years on European and New York stages. And there is Audra McDonald in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill in 2014. The Broadway great won the Best Actress Tony for her brilliant portrayal. In the movies category now playing, the article is called Truth to Power. A trio of new dramas torn from real-life headlines test the boundaries of storytelling. This is by Leah Greenblatt. Justice may follow a long arc, but more than ever lately, it seems to wend its way to a biopic, or at least that's true of several movies out this month, two of which make the case for their real-life counterparts in a way that newsprint or history books likely never could. The first movie is Judas and the Black Messiah. The story of late Black Panther Fred Hampton has been on the screen before via several documentaries and more recently a fine supporting turn by Kelvin Harrison Jr. in last year's buzzy Aaron Sorkin drama The Trial of the Chicago Seven. All that pales, though, next to Daniel Kaluuya's powerhouse performance in Shaka King's Judas and the Black Messiah. That's how completely the British actor embodies Hampton, a Chicago native whose perceived radicalism and unquestionable charisma made him a prime target of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI in the late 1960s. Hoover, played by Martin Sheen, glowering under a thick putty of prosthetics, wanted black power neutralized, which meant enlisting an agent, played by Jesse Plemons, to recruit a petty car thief, played by Lakeith Stanfield, to infiltrate the local Panther Party, befriend Fred, and ultimately betray him. King, who also co-wrote the script, gives Messiah a lush, high theatrical style, full of artful tableau and restless, rippling energy. But it's Kaluuya, alternately raw, tender, and incendiary, who electrifies every scene he's in. Leah Greenblatt rates Judas and the Black Messiah an A-. Next we have The Mauritian. The Mauritian serves as a similar kind of showcase for its own remarkable star, Tahar Rahim, as Mahamadou Al-Salahi, the accused 9/11 mastermind held for years without charges at Guantanamo. Toggling seamlessly between English, French, and Arabic, he's a mystery even the Oscar bait cast around him, a pleasingly astringent Jodie Foster is his pro bono defender, and Benedict Cumberbatch, the courtly Marine Corps lawyer assigned to prosecute him, struggles to crack. Should Slahi own his crimes, or were they confessed to under unconstitutional torture? Though director Kevin MacDonald from The Last King of Scotland leans into some familiar dramatic beats, the end result still feels like a reckoning. Leah Greenblatt rates The Mauritian a B+. And there's Silk Road. When Ross Ulbricht, played by Love Simon's Nick Robinson, shouts about taking back our liberty in Tiller Russell's Silk Road, it has a different ring. Ulbricht's idea of freedom meant creating the titular drug hub on the dark web, a Costco-style clearinghouse for everything from Xanax to heroin. Of course, he's only exploiting loopholes, and a circa 2011 cybersecurity squad is soon after him, including a combative veteran cop played by Jason Clark, whose bad behavior has recently gotten him consigned to desk duty. Clark is great, but it all feels a little callow. The Social Network, redrawn in weed and wispy startup beards. Leah Greenblatt rates Silk Road a C+. Movies, Meet Your Maker. We're meeting Robin Wright. From The Princess Bride to House of Cards, Wright, 54, has an acting resume that speaks for itself. But she makes her feature film directorial debut with Land, out now, about a grieving woman who turns to nature for healing. Here she shares her biggest artistic inspirations. This is by Samantha Highfill. And there are five of them here. The first one, The Black Stallion. For Land, Wright had to figure out how to use nature as a part of her story. And for that, she looked to one of her favorite films of all time, 1979's The Black Stallion. The horse and the boy are characters in the movie, but nature and where they live, that environment was a character as well. That was really important to have in this film, Wright says, noting that she also watched Never Cry Wolf from 1983 for those same reasons. Number two, Jeremiah Johnson. Without much dialogue in Land, Wright also had to master using silence, so she found herself watching films like this 1972 Robert Redford-led Western. That's another really quiet film in the snow, says Wright, who focused heavily on sound design, because when no one's talking, nature is talking. Number three, Julian Schnabel. Because Land follows Edie, played by Wright, in the aftermath of losing her husband and son, her memories play a crucial role, which is why Wright thought of Schnabel and, specifically, The Diving Bell and The Butterfly from 2007. That was a huge, huge influence, Wright says, of what she calls another all-time favorite. To examine how that film shot flashbacks, she had her crew watch some of it during shooting. Number four, Anthony Minghella. In 2006, Wright worked with the Oscar-winning director on Breaking and Entering, and his method stuck with her. He would tell stories before you did the scene, she remembers. He would take a piece from a novel he'd read or a poem, and you're thinking, this has nothing to do with the scene. But when he'd finished the story, you realized, that's exactly what I needed to get to the emotion. And number five, David Fincher. Before directing her first House of Cards episode in 2014, Wright called the Oscar nominee in a panic. I said, can you give me something? Then he said, think of a fraction and put the word behavior on the top of the line and the word time underneath. So it's behavior over time. That's all you need to remember. And then he hung up. Wright says it clicked for her at 2 a.m. Behavior is the most important thing. That was Meet Your Maker with Robin Wright, and it was by Samantha Highfill. Our next article is called Method Man. Tahar Rahim gives a must-see breakout performance in the 9/11 drama The Mauritian. The French actor hopes audiences pay attention to its message, too. This is by Lauren Huff. Reality, Tahar Rahim reminds us, is often stranger than fiction, especially in the case of the disturbing true story behind this new film, The Mauritian, on PVOD March 2nd. Kevin MacDonald's sobering post-9/11 legal drama follows a pair of attorneys, played by Jodie Foster and Shailene Woodley, who uncover a conspiracy in the treatment of Mohamedou Ould Slahi, played by Rahim, a suspect in the terrorist attacks who's been held for years, uncharged, as a prisoner at Guantanamo Bay. Slahi's best-selling account of his ordeal, Guantanamo Diary, out 2015, formed the basis of the film. He never lost hope, even as his book describes horrific experiences of torture. You can't imagine how impressive it is to meet this man when you know what happened to him, says Rahim, 39. He is a lifetime lesson. The demanding role ought to bring more attention from U.S. audiences to Raheem, whose decorated global career includes a César Award for 2009's A Prophet. To prepare, the multilingual French actor lost more than 20 pounds and added two new languages to his repertoire, Hassaniya Arabic and Classical Arabic. He had the props team get him real shackles and asked that his cell be kept as cold as possible while he was sprayed with water and force-fed. It was very, very difficult, he admits, but at the same time, putting yourself in this position helps you reach an emotional space that you would never be able to reach if you don't put yourself in those conditions. Sahi was released and returned to his native Mauritania after 14 years, but to this day, he's still close friends with one of his guards. This unlikely reality stuck with Raheem, and the actor hopes it resonates with others. I couldn't really understand how you could turn anger into forgiveness after you got through this, he says, but I'd like the audience to know that a man like this exists, and to pick love over anger, and to pick forgiveness over doubts and fear. That was Method Man by Lauren Huff. Here we have a sidebar, the essential to hear Raheem. See why he's an internationally revered actor. In 2009, he was in A Prophet. Raheem won major awards for his role as a petty criminal in the French thriller. The Past in 2013, Berenice Bejo from The Artist starred with Raheem in the lauded martial drama. And The Looming Tower in 2018. In Hulu's Starry miniseries about the lead-up to 9/11, Raheem played a torn FBI agent. That was your essential to hear Raheem. Next in movies, something lighter, the article's called Funny Business. Dan Stevens, whose comedy gold in the British farce Blythe Spirit on Video on Demand February 19th, gives us his three rules for great madcap. This is by Maureen Lee Linker. There's emotional infidelity, and then there's being haunted by the ghost of your first wife. Here's how Dan Stevens mines his comic instincts to portray writer Charles Condamine's spectral face-offs. Number one, find the tone. When it comes to performing the works of Noel Coward, timing and tone are everything. I had to tap into the comedic rhythms of Coward, how obedient you have to be as an actor to the score of the text, says Stevens, 38, and just because it's a period piece doesn't mean it's old-fashioned. Once you get into the tone of it, you can transcend the period, the actor explains. This adaptation is so lively. There's something very zany about Blythe's spirit that is just timeless and wild and funny. Number two, have fun. You don't want to take it too seriously, Stevens stresses. There can be a tendency, whenever something is set in the past, we get a bit reverent with it. The idea in some people's minds that history and humor are mutually exclusive is weird to me. Stevens also looked to his leading ladies, Isla Fisher and Leslie Mann, for their contemporary experience. With their modern comedic instincts, they brought the tone up to a modern audience's ear, he reflects. I was keen to broaden the tone of it. And number three, undermine with abandon. Stevens went for broke in scenes like the one where he tears after Elvira's ghost, played by Mann, during the funeral of his second wife, Ruth, played by Fisher. The actors were playing the serious scene mourning Ruth's death. I came along across the lawn with this croquet mallet and undermined all of the beautiful grounded work they've done, screaming back and forth, he says. Any serious grief is whipped away by this man who's been driven mad. That's what gives it a comedic dynamic. That was Funny Business by Maureen Lee Linker. We have a Q&A here with Desus and Mero. A pandemic couldn't hold back Showtime's duo from a breakthrough 2020, with presidents and TV legends confirming their status as the new kings of late night. Next up, the brand gets stronger. This is by Darren French. They made TV history from a Bronx sneaker closet and a New Jersey basement. That's where Daniel Desus Nice Baker and Joel the Kid Mero Martinez started recording remotely last March. Their Showtime series, Desus and Mero, hit new heights in the shadow of COVID. The duo interviewed presidents and late-night luminaries, officiated a Zoom wedding, and turned Arrest the Cops Who Killed Breonna Taylor into a regular sign-off. All that, plus the best-selling book, God-Level Knowledge Darts, and their hit, Bodega Boys, podcast. With Season 3 airing Sundays and Thursdays at 11 p.m., Desus and Mero look back on their transformative year and ahead to a brighter future. The first question is, what's new this year? Mero says, I had to get a separate shooting space. I got 4 kids, a dog, and my wife is home a lot. He points to a Zoom background. This is an apartment in Fair Lawn, New Jersey. No more working from home. And Desus says, what I'm super excited for this season is there's going to be no Trump. You have to find humor in other places. How hard was the transition to filming at home? Desus says, now we're tech geniuses. We might open a genius bar on the side. You're going to see us fixing MacBooks while we're doing our monologues. And Mero says, we're children of immigrants. We're supposed to have multiple jobs. We have the number one show in late night, but we're also members of the Geek Squad. Desus, I remember someone saying to me, the idea that every time I see you on the show, you're still working from home makes me not feel bad about the fact I've been home. Mero, we are each other's audience. We didn't have that difficulty transitioning as much as other hosts because we entertain each other. Desus, we had a meeting to figure out what's going on as far as going back to the studio. Time is so nebulous now. Are we gonna be around in October? Are we gonna have a functioning government in October? Mero, is it October now? Here's the next question. Did you expect to become an essential campaign stop in 2020? Desus, having our show be a political stopping point is wild. We could be kingmakers. Low key, we might start taking bribes. You want to talk to the urban audience. You've got to grease some palms, you know what I'm saying? Mero, we're the hood lobbyists. Next question, you also hit a whole new level of illustriousness with your guests. Does that raise the stakes for the new season? Desus says, at this point, it's not a matter of, do you want to be on our show? Now it's a matter of people writing us, yo, when am I going to be on your show? Mero, having David Letterman be like, this is what a late night show should be, is like Michael Jordan telling you that you're good at basketball. Desus, we're trying to do back-to-back championships. Corona tried to stop the wave, and we're still going. We interviewed Obama, and now people are like, who are you going to interview now? The only person right now we get intimidated interviewing is Putin. Mero, as long as we have a Geiger counter with us around Putin, we're good. Question, you've also found room for more serious-minded segments, like the wedding or your great chat with aspiring Dr. Nina Leach. What's it like blending humor with heart? Desus, in the beginning of COVID, I would walk around my neighborhood and see those white trucks by the hospital full of dead bodies. When people are dealing with that all day, you want to give them something good to come home to. Question, if you're successful in late night, you can do the job for decades. What's your plan? Mero, the book proved that what we do translates to almost any medium. We've done TV, we've done podcasts, we've done radio. Where else is there to do? Movies, you know, that's next on tap. Desus, we can still do this for a couple more seasons. Season 60, we'll be out here with the hoop earring and the gray beard and the hologram children. Mero, Rockstar Games, holler at your boys. Maybe you need 2 main characters in Grand Theft Auto 6? Desus, everyone is like, you and Mero should have a radio station in GTAVI. No, we want to be the main characters. That was the Q&A with Desus and Mero with Darren French. And then the sidebar is TV pet peeves. Desus likes tiny pretty things and Your Honor. Mero's re-binging The Sopranos between Paw Patrol episodes. And eternal quarantine means extra time to find quirks in old and new shows. This is also by Darren French. The sudden budget boost. Certain shows, season one, you can see the network was like, I don't know, says King of Queens expert Deesis. Season three, all of a sudden they got special guests and exterior shots. The high def evolution. Going from SD to HD, the quality is so stark, says Miro. I've started seeing that when I'm rewatching Sex and the City, Deesis agrees. Is that Magnolia Bakery? I can't read that. And on-screen social distancing. The pair are also noticing pandemic workarounds in newer TV episodes. You'll see a scene where two people are on a bench, says Deesis, but they're never right next to each other. That was Deesis and Miro's Pet Peeves with Darren French. In the short couple minutes we have left, I'm going to the What to Watch section so you know what to be watching this week. This is your guide to March's essential viewing, and it's by Dan Snyerson. The featured show is Coming to America. That will be out Friday, March 5th on Amazon Prime Video. 33 years after Coming to America hit theaters, before some of you could tie your own shoes, which King Jaffe Joffer, played by James Earl Jones, considers to be an overrated experience, Prince Akeem, played by Eddie Murphy, has been crowned King of Zamunda. When he learns he has a son in Queens, Akeem returns to the States to ready the prince-to-be. Arsenio Hall is back, Leslie Jones is in, and you're suddenly craving McDowell's. Monday on March 1st is the season premiere of The Voice. Gwen Stefani exits. Nick Jonas returns. Hard to believe the American Idol revival has now been on the air for 10 years, 20 seasons, and one scary chair malfunction for Kelly Clarkson. Tuesday, March 2nd, season premiere of New Amsterdam on NBC. Friday, March 5th, it's Boss Level. That's on Hulu. Think Groundhog Day if Bill Murray and a few groundhogs kept getting blown up. Tuesday, March 9th, it's a series premiere on Oprah Winfrey Network, Delilah. And Friday, March 12th, it's Cherry on Apple TV Plus. Your typical college dropout turned army medic turned war hero turned PTSD victim turned opioid addict turned bank robber turned senator. Oops, take back that last turn story. And that's enough recommendations for us. We'll keep looking at this one through the month. And this wraps up the time for Entertainment Weekly. We got in a lot of Golden Globes information just in time for the show. I don't think we've ever been so timely. And started the March issue of Entertainment Weekly. Come back next week and we'll start getting into the March issue properly with the must list. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American at 3. This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we continue our series of Oscar-winning films. This year, the Academy Awards ceremony is Sunday, April 25th. Each Saturday until April 24th, we'll select an audio-described movie from each decade that won the Academy Award for Best Picture. Saturday, we're showing All About Eve from 1950, starring Betty Davis, Ann Baxter, and George Sanders, and directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. Praised by critics at the time of its release, All About Eve received a record 14 Academy Award nominations and won 6, including Best Picture. Widely considered to be one of the greatest films of all time, All About Eve was one of the first 50 films selected for preservation in the United States Library of Congress's National Film Registry.
I'm going to take you to Margot. Oh, no. Oh, yes, she's got to meet you. There isn't another like you.
Week after week, to thousands of people, you're as young as you want.
As young as they want you. I'm not 20-ish. I'm not 30-ish. 3 months ago, I was 40 years old. 40. Got to see her. She worships you. It's like something out of a book. You're her whole life.
Have you really seen every performance?
I'd like anything, Miss Channing.
Would you really? How sweet.
Stick around. We'll go somewhere and talk.
being here with Miss Channing has been a... I just can't say.
Suddenly I've developed a big protective feeling toward her. A lamb loose in our big stone jungle.
She thinks only about you anyway.
How do you mean that?
Like she's studying you. Like it was a play